So here we are today on Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015, and I, Josephine Ensign, here with Mary Pilgrim. My great pleasure to be here with one of my favorite nurses. So what we're going to be doing today is oral history on Skid Road. It's a project to increase an understanding of the complexity of charity healthcare in King County, Washington. And so, Mary, what I wanted to ask you just first with it is, what led you to the work that you do?
Believe it or not, almost all of my 42 years in nursing has been working within a university setting, either in San Diego at the University of California and then up at Harborview, a few years of private sector. And I've always been drawn to people that had need and to try to make, even if it's a tiny little difference in somebody's life, to be able to help them along the line or give them some support or what they need. And as the years go by, I've got more and more involved, especially within the university systems, who both of them had county contracts for mental health, for people that were in jail, for drug addictions, for no family support, et cetera, and yet needing care that sometimes they were not given appropriately. So it just progressed from there. Did I ever think I would ever work in a shelter, which I really knew nothing about, even while I worked at Harborview? No. And when I went down, I figured, well, it's 2 years. Well, I've been there a lot longer than that, and find I like working down there.
And there is at DESC, is that right?
Yes, there is DESC, which is one of the largest shelter in town and has now, I think, 9 or 10 housing units that are meant for people coming, a lot of them coming out of DESC that need a lot of support in their housing to make it a success.
So tell me a little bit about what you do, about your work now.
I actually have a little mini clinic and I see patients all day long. For some of them, I can't figure out why they came in, but there had to be a reason. But due to their mental health, they may not know why they came in, but in hopes that they'll come back the next time, because it was a successful, you know, event for them. I do a lot of dressing changes. I do a lot of going over medications so that they have an understanding of why the importance. I do basic clinic things with basic meds for colds and flus and pregnancy tests, and I connect them to providers if there aren't any, and whatever else falls in the middle. A lot of seizures. I see people on, you know, I often am out in the shelter because there's seizures. Usually I can stop most of the ambulance calls because rarely are they needed. It's just happens when I'm not there and can't give them bus tickets or can't get them a cab, or I call AMR direct if I really need to get them up there. Occasionally the medics have to show up because respirations of 4 or whatever need a little bit more support than what I necessarily have. Although now all of DESC will have nasal Narcan, and it's in the shelters now. So hopefully some of the disasters can be reduced,
right,
because of their drug use.
So, and that's just for people that don't know that, that's the medication that helps reverse overdose from a narcotic.
From Narcan, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And when you say up there, I'm assuming, are you meaning Harborview?
The hospital.
Up right up the hill?
And I deal equally, I mean, probably more with Harborview, but I deal equally with all the hospitals in the area. I accept all the medical referrals to the shelter. Shelter's usually full, but there are 5 beds. So I usually screen and accept people from the hospitals that are being discharged and have to be careful that they will survive. I mean, they can manage there because they have to be independent with their ADLs. They don't have to be clean and sober. It's a low-barrier shelter, but they do have to be able to take care of themselves to be there. I have people on oxygen. I have people on CPAP. I have people on dialysis. And the population is getting sicker, older, and no place to go because a lot of them have burnt their bridges every place else in town. So as they're getting sicker, the problem is where do they go other than boarding in a hospital for several months because they can't find nursing homes for them.
So then a lot of times they end up staying at DESC
As long as they can manage. You know, it's hard. The staff there are young. They're new grads, a lot of them social service new grads, but they're not medical, you know. So the only thing they can do when things is call an ambulance.
If you're not there.
If I'm not there, right. Yeah.
So do you have a fair number that go to the Jefferson to the hospice program, or is that?
It depends. I mean, occasionally they get to me because there's no room and I sit on it for a while and then try to get them back in later. But Jefferson Terrace is filled most of the time, almost all the time.
Mm-hmm. So not a whole lot of places to send people.
No, we're kind of at the, if, often we're it for a lot of people.
Right.
And if we can't take them, they end up in a hospital just there for months because I can't find any place for them.
So you said a little bit earlier you never imagined that you would be working in a homeless shelter.
Right.
Do you remember, can you describe a little bit like when you first were working with people who you were aware were homeless?
Well, but in a university setting, you work with homeless populations all the time. So that part wasn't really an issue. It was just thinking that I wouldn't be in the hospital and you don't have the support, you don't have all the bells and whistles. And I am it. There is no one else except me in the shelter. And I am phone contact with Nancy Suggs, who is the at Pioneer Square Clinic, is the attending that if I have a problem. But most of it is just handled in the clinic because it's day-to-day life and not something that she necessarily has to get involved with all the time. But if I have questions, that's my base to go to.
All right. So then before the shelter work, you had mostly been inpatient in the hospital?
I came out of as hospital supervisor at Harborview, and when I first went there, I was in the burn unit as, you know, an ICU nurse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'd been all the rest of my career, was either in ICU management or as staff in an ICU. I've never worked on a floor. Never worked on a floor, so.
And before this current work, had you done community nursing at all or public health nursing?
No. It's always been in a hospital.
Right.
So at then, one level. So it was a big change.
Right. That would be definitely. So what would you say, like, what's a memorable highlight for you in your career? What's something that stands out for you that?
The success to move somebody forward that maybe hasn't had a housing for 20 years and to help them through that process, get them well first, and then have them go into housing and have them come back and say, I don't ever want to be homeless again. You know, and they're happy, they look good, they're healthy because they're following through with their doctors. Those are the successes.
Mm-hmm.
And any little piece in between that you can gain along that line.
So you've had some people who that's happened to and they come back and talk with you, mm-hmm, after they've been, mm-hmm, been stable in housing for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I have or if they're inpatient, to call me to tell me where they are,
mm,
and how they're doing. And I'm going, so.
Right. So they keep in touch with you,
mm-hmm,
in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And what are some of the biggest frustrations that you've encountered in your work?
People that need maybe some surgeries that nobody will do because they're not in a house. or an apartment, which, you know, to them means often they're a lesser citizen, they're not entitled, and trying to say, you know, some of it, you can't have some of this surgery and still be homeless. You need, you know, something. But that's not what they see. They just see a need, and that it's just another negative thing in their life that they can't get.
So that gets pretty frustrating for you.
It does.
Right.
You know, and sometimes I can work through it and work around them and get to the right person, and sometimes it just doesn't work. So you're just kind of continuously kind of picking up the pieces to kind of help them along, and let's work on getting you housed. And then you can go forward with the next step. So.
Okay. And what kind of, so your entire time at Harborview, in terms of being a supervisor, being in the ICU, and then now working at DESC, how long has that been?
27 years.
27 years. So what kind of changes would you say that that stand out to you in terms of the system of care, especially around homeless
services? The homeless community. I think in general it has improved. It's got a long ways to go. I think my vision for the future is to not do so much duplicating of services where everybody gets a couple of dollars, then nothing really goes forward. You just kind of give them a bed to sleep on, but nothing really goes forward. And with some of the big places, like having a true clinic where there truly is a prescriber, whether it's an ARNP or volunteer doctors that come in but have a stable, where they really can come in and get care. A lot of the problems with the homeless community following through with care is the responsibility of keeping appointments. And most of it kind of comes out to instant gratification. Oh, I got a pain, I need to go to the ER. Where we go, I got a pain, or let me make an appointment with my doctor and see him in a week. That is not what goes through most of their minds. It's, I need it now, you know. And with a clinic within the shelters, like some of them in Washington, D.C. have, you could meet some of that instant gratification without, you know, having such a high ER cost because their finger is sore.
All right. So then that would be one of your dreams would be to maybe expand the clinic that you're in to include.
So that there really can be some providers that can do the scripts and do a little bit more referral into specialty clinics without having to get them into the ER to get that done.
Right. So maybe something like an expanded Pioneer Square clinic or
I think it's actually going to have to be on site.
Right.
In order to be successful.
Okay. All right. And so, and what kind of other hopes would you have for like the larger safety net? Services in King County. So that's something very concrete in terms of having an expanded clinic
on site at
DESC. And then I heard maybe more coordination of services.
Well, to kind of help reduce some of the duplications that are around town. I mean, money's tight. I see it getting tighter. And to maximize everything as much as possible that's done with those dollars.
Mm-hmm. And so duplication, like what would you say is an example? Doesn't have to be a specific place if you don't want to call them out, but a service.
Well, it say they only sleep people at night, and therefore they don't do any – and, you know, there isn't much else that they can do because they don't come in until like 7 or 9 o'clock at night, and they have to leave at 5 o'clock in the morning. Well, there isn't any connection to help them go forward. As much as, you know, where if they were joined together a little bit more, there may be a better – or connect with the clinic or, you know, Carolyn Downs, 40 – I mean, all of them, but to connect more so that they can refer them all in. There are some vans now that are going out at night that are beginning to be able to help the people on the street that won't come into a shelter.
And so, and do you coordinate with some of those?
I haven't.
But you know that they exist. Yeah. And so, and before we started the interview today, you and I were talking about what you just returned from in terms of working with the VA. So can you tell me a little bit about your work with that and what you hope for that part of it in the future?
For that part of it, I had been invited to a meeting on how to catch up with the VA people that are being underserved because maybe their mental health or drugs, and trying to connect. And from there, I ended up being invited to a national conference back in Philadelphia regarding research project that's being done on palliative care for the homeless vets that aren't being taken care of by the veterans. And it kind of will be an ongoing and an outreach, and that's where I see some of the homeless shelters being able to help support and bring forth the names or the vet that they've seen so that those people maybe can be interviewed. Found out that there is a way now for vets that have, say, like served 2-3 years and had been discharged for whatever the behavior was or the mental health, there is now a way that they could get palliative care for the last kind of 6 months through the VA, which kind of not very many people knew about. So there was a lot of, and most of the people that were there were all policymakers. So it was a very interesting where they are trying to go to and the barriers they're running into trying to get there, and the same as anybody else, the funding to make the programs work and trying to get the funding just to keep the outreach program that is at the VA now that I'm sure a lot of people don't know about that actually go out in the shelters to seek out the vets that aren't being taken care of and get them back into the veterans.
All right, like Dr. Reddy.
Like Dr.
Yeah,
Reddy.
Right, mm-hmm. And his team.
And his team.
A nurse and a social worker.
And a social worker.
Mm-hmm. So, and I assume you interact with them
yes.
around
mm-hmm.
some of the vets' issues. And just in case listeners don't understand palliative care, because how do you define?
Well, palliative care is kind of it's a negative word in a lot of our clients because it's just another thing of hopelessness mm-hmm. is so sometimes not calling it that you can get people into the system a little bit better, but it's meant for like people that are maybe 6 months away. They're end-stage lung disease, they've got cancer, they've got, you know, whatever's going on with them. It's getting them in and bringing some dignity to their life and making them comfortable as can be.
All right, so similar to hospice.
It's earlier than hospice.
So, yeah, it starts earlier.
It starts earlier. Hospice right. is the last.
Right. So what do you try to call it instead of palliative care with people that you find gets it across but not in so negative way?
I try to say, have you talked with the VA about, you know, what's going to happen in the next few months as far as your care, you know, or what's going to happen? Have they discussed with you how this disease progresses and what you want out of the deal? And that brings for a little bit more response. Because it doesn't sound quite so like I don't have a chance.
Or that they've given up on me.
They've given up on
right,
me.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So, and what have you seen in terms of the kind of the interaction and overlap between the VA system and Harborview, especially with the clients, the patients
a
that you work
with? A lot of them go both places. You know, I mean, again, what's closer from where I'm? Harborview.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it goes into that instant, and often that's closer, and often they end up in the ER there.
Right. And you were also talking earlier about, it wasn't patient navigators, but you were telling me about a situation within the VA system where they're
called a peer counselor. And they actually identify their clients and actually take their hand and walk them through the system so that the barrier doors are down and they open the doors and just physically walk them through the system to get them enrolled and get them where they need to go.
So you've seen that working out pretty well?
There aren't very many of them, but they're very successful in getting their clients where they need to go and getting them through the federal system.
Right, which is pretty complex.
Yeah.
Right. All right. And so we went over some of the joys and so what – and like – and you talked about kind of the success stories and the things like that help you to kind of see, I would imagine, like what you are doing and what the system is doing that's positive for people. But any like one specific situation, you know, you don't have to disclose, you know, identifying details, but like anything in particular of a certain patient who stands out to you in your work?
I mean, it's a challenge when quite often the one that wants the ambulance should have been going to their private doctor. It's the one that I want the ambulance for, and they refuse to go for whatever their agenda is, which often I don't know. And having to, because if they say no, the ambulance or medics aren't going to take them. And there's been times I've had to let them actually get sicker where they couldn't argue with me anymore and go to the hospital. And then they come back and say, I was really sick, wasn't I? And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. And you resisted. Well, I know I shouldn't have, but I mean, those are the ones. I mean, I had a man not too long ago that came in, I don't feel good. And he's gray. He's ashen. I said, you need to go to the ER. I'm not going to the ER. I am not going to the ER. And he was so agitated. Let him go sit out just outside my door. And, of course, I stand up to look. Where is he? He's gone. And pretty soon he comes back looking worse than what he did to start with. And I said, where did you go? I went to the store because I wanted some chocolate milk. Mm. Collapsed in the store. Refused the medics. Because he was coming back up to see me. And I ended up calling the medics. We hooked him up, and he was right in the middle of a massive MI. Mm. And went from there to the cath lab and came back, and he goes, I was really sick. I feel so good now. Yeah, well, you almost didn't get out of my office, let alone, you know, and they just don't see it.
Right. So how do you try to establish that trust with them? What kinds of things have you found helpful?
I try not to be – when they do something stupid I or shoot up again or whatever, I often say, it didn't work out very good, did it? And I think that's a statement I use quite often. You know, how'd that work? Well, it didn't. Okay. And I leave it alone. They don't need to be told. They know. They don't need somebody to rag on them. People with super high blood pressure, see, they don't feel it, so therefore it's not there. And I never say, well, you could die, because that's not a threat to most people that are homeless. That's an end of a life of torture for some of them. Mm-hmm. But if you say, your arm might not work, or you may not be able to walk, or how about you can't talk? Now, that makes them vulnerable on the street. That makes a difference. Not that they're going to die.
So figuring out what really matters to to them.
So often the med students, I said, you say it this way because you're going to get a response. You say you're going to die, they're not going to change. So
right. It's
finding out how to say it to make their difference.
So getting to know them as well.
And what their priorities are.
Right. So what do you find are some of the common barriers in terms of or experiences that your clients have with the emergency room?
Negativeness.
In what way?
Or perceived negativeness. Well, they didn't believe me, or they didn't, you know, or they didn't treat me nice, or they didn't, you know. A lot of it's perceived, but it's still real to them. And often you have to kind of, so often they'll go, they didn't get what they wanted at Harborview, so they go across to Swedish. And that could be like in a two-hour period. And they're not aware that all these, that everybody is kind of connected. And even when I tell them that, they still, you know, well, I didn't get the meds I wanted here, so I'll go see if I can get them some from Swedish.
So a little bit of shopping, right?
So they do a lot of shopping.
When you say connected, what do you mean by that? Are they kind of shared?
Well, they've all got high utilizers in the ER, you know, and now with the Epic and Access, you know where they've been once you plug them into Epic. I mean, it comes up and tells you where they've been within the area.
And Epic being the kind of the online.
The charting system.
Yeah, the charting system, right. Yeah. So have you seen anything, especially like Harborview, Swedish, which is, those are the closest ones to DESE where you are, anything in terms of like the Hotspotters program with a, like trying to identify the high utilizers?
Well, that's the high utilizers teams. And all the hospitals have a high utilizer team that, you know, gets zoned in on the ones that are up there all the time. I work with a lot of them. You know, do they stay down there? What can we do to eliminate their constant coming up here? What can we, you know, trying to work to see why it is they're coming up there? And there's some success, but yet not always.
Right.
But at least it helps, gives them an active case manager that will address them when they come in up there, will help, as if necessary, walk them to their housing, to a housing appointment, just to make sure they don't come back up. You know, so they do a lot of case management. They do a lot of traveling around to where the clients might be, to get them to appointments, to get them just to help them stay out of the ER.
All right. So then you work with those teams,
yes.
The high utilizer
yes.
teams,
mm-hmm.
a fair amount.
Mm-hmm.
And with any other of the systems, or is it mostly Harborview and Swedish?
Swedish, the VA, Virginia Mason, Northwest. I do a fair amount with Northwest, especially with their ER. Then we do Valley. Highline gets up and Tacoma General. I mean, so it's kind of
very regional. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. So, and if you could maybe think about your younger self, like say 25, 30 years ago, if you can remember yourself back then, what would you want to tell that younger self, like things that you know now, especially around your work, that you would like to tell her?
Yeah, I'll probably roll with the punches a little bit more. I think that's the listen. You know, listen to what they're telling you, because they'll tell you what's going on. It may not be the way you expect to hear it, but they will tell you. You just need to be a little bit more patient. And I think as healthcare and nurses and ICUs, you don't often allow that to happen because of what else you're doing at the time. So,
like those checklists you were telling me
yeah.
about that
the student, of, you know, yeah. they're coming in, they're going to, you know, they have to do this assessment and they want to go, you know, you need to kind of get the answers where you can. Take it where it goes, fill in the blanks later, but you'll get the answers. It just may, you got to be a little bit more resourceful and just relax. They'll give it to you.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what you tell the younger students too.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And other things that you try to pass on to the students?
Yeah, just yeah. how to approach some of the guys. I pick the clients that they see. So I do not get them set up with somebody that I know has potential for violence. I teach them you never allow the client to be between you and the door, which I think once they're down there in the shelter, it makes more sense than when it is up in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
there are some of them that come down quite frightened that they're going to get killed down there. I've had going, no, these are the same people you deal with in the hospital. The difference is when they're up there, they play by your rules. When you're down here, you're in their home, and the rules are going to be a little different. And they're going to get up and walk out on you if they're done. They're done, they're going to leave.
Right. And then you were telling me besides health professional students, profession students like med students or nursing students, you also do some training with paramedics and the police?
New paramedics come through DESC and spend a day there. And all new SPD classes come through and spend a day in the shelter. And the goal is to get them to see what a homeless population is all about, to gain more trust in the staff when their staff are saying whatever, or this guy is, you know, we think he's got a gun, we think, you know, and they need to learn that the staff really do know the clients. And if they don't, they're going to tell them so, you know. And the same with the docs, you know, read the notes, because you're writing stuff that's not true if you'd have just read my note, which doesn't get done very often. Mm.
So that sounds like a frustration.
Yeah, I think it is for everybody. I mean, they're pressed for time, too. They don't have time sometimes to sit and read. And in the beginning, they're told not to read so that they don't get a preset idea about somebody.
Right. Yeah, I have heard that from people. Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's okay. I mean, it's just like, you know, well, where have you been? I always ask where they've been for the, you know, or how did you get here? Well, I've been in prison. I never ask why. I don't need to know why. Mm-hmm. I usually can guess, depending on where they've been, what they've done to get there. But I never ask why, which leaves them with a little bit more dignity. They're not proud of it, so leave it alone.
Right. Right. And it probably wouldn't change like how you
no.
or it could do it in terms of a negative effect.
Well,
on
it
what
could
you care.
Depending on what it was. So it I just don't. I ask where they've been, but I don't ask why.
Right.
I mean, you can. That's online. If you want to know, you can look it up. Which, you know, this it is done because we need to know it for safety. But nobody uses it for anything. Because it's a low-barrier shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And part of low barriers are people that have been in prison or do have warrants or do – police don't come in during the day to make rounds because it's a home. They want these guys. They know how to get – there's only one door out of the building. They know mm-hmm. how to find them.
Right. A lot of times when I'm down there, I see the police interacting with them, like down near the bus mm-hmm. stop and mm-hmm. things like that. All right. So, and I know you wrote some notes down. So are there other things that I haven't asked you about that you were hoping that I did or you wanted to add?
I don't think the general people know that. I mean, you're only dealing with mentally ill, but you're only dealing with drugs. You're dealing with no families, that they're estranged from financial issues, immigration issues, that maybe they're here illegally, but they still get sick. You know, and don't have any income. So what do they do about the copay when the hospitals say, but you owe me a dollar? They don't have a dollar. And there are places that won't give them their medication. So here you've got somebody with pneumonia, and they won't give them the meds because they need a dollar. Now, they've just spent, what, $1,500 or whatever going through the ER. Won't give them, you know, $5 worth of medication. So what's going to happen? They're going to come back to the ER again because of a couple of dollars worth of antibiotics. Somehow that's got to be adjusted. And it just boils down to finances again. But it's a real life problem.
And you see that across the board, including like from Harborview?
Not so much from there, but from a lot of the outlying places. So I have to make sure when I take a referral from places, I say, and they do have their medication in hand. Well, we know we thought you'd provide it. No, mm-hmm. they need to come with it or they're we can't take them. They have to have their medication.
So then that puts the onus back on the, yes, the hospital.
Yes.
Because they legally can't discharge somebody to the streets. Right.
Yeah. But that's a big, you know, that's an issue. I think it's gotten better, but it's still a problem. We talked about the instant gratification. That's very real. The lack of low-income housing. And a lot of the people that I deal with need a supportive housing. I mean, they can have an apartment, but there needs to be 24-hour support within that building to make sure everything is going for and that they're all right and they get checked on because they're not quite ready to be totally, totally independent, that they need a little support. The ESC does a good job on that because they try to open a new building every year, and each building is about 70 to 80 apartments.
And mostly supportive then.
And if they're all supportive.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So what do you see currently in terms of the low-income housing and supportive housing? Is it getting worse, better, staying
the same?
It's getting worse. Getting worse.
I mean, trying to get a place in Seattle for them is pretty much a nightmare right now. So a lot of it goes south down into the Renton area. There seems to be a better way to get them some low-income housing down in there. But they have to be pretty capable of managing on their own when they're down in there. Get an apartment. So if they're not ready to really stand on their feet, get their meals, find food, manage their finances, next thing you know, they've lost their apartment for non-pay.
Right. Well, and also I would imagine getting back to their health care places,
yes,
as well. Right.
It's, yeah, getting follow. I mean, shelters are hard, but they're meant to provide a safety net to get them off the streets so they're not preyed on by not only men but women. There are predators with both sexes.
Mm-hmm.
And get them in where it's safe so they understand they can come to the staff if they're being victimized. Identifying the predators. And once they're identified, then they're asked to leave because they don't want the vulnerable people being preyed on. So food is always a big issue, although in Seattle, pretty much nobody should be hungry because there's lots and lots of food sources. Substance abuse programs are there if you can get them to take it. What else? Getting their clothes washed.
Right, just basically.
Getting them to wash or shower, period, mm-hmm, is a major problem with the very mentally ill.
Right, just basic taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But back to the substance abuse ones, when do you find that they're, in terms of accessibility, when people want to get treatment, is there enough?
No.
And
there's a waiting list. I mean, they're calling every day to get into a program that's full. And after they call 4 or 5 days in a row, pretty soon it dwindles off because they couldn't get in when they were ready to go. Therefore, they're back using again.
So they kind of give up on it. Mm-hmm. Has that gotten worse or better or about the same?
I think it's about the same.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only so many beds. There's, you know, I mean, they can only accommodate until they're full. So,
right. So that's a problem.
So, yeah. Clothing. Lots of clothing banks around. I can't think. What else? Increased collaborations with businesses in the area so that they understand and know who to get support from without always having to call the police if there is a client in the store that's bothering them. And getting them to be supportive and know how to kind of de-escalate if somebody's in their store. And financially, to get support from the business community to help keep these people going forward.
So that's something that the DESE staff work on? And you...
The administration does,
right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So, I can't think of anything else probably that I haven't touched on. Well, if I'm not there, there's no one where I'm at. It just there's no one until I come back. So as soon as I walk out the door, the fire department pays probably most, because as soon as I walk out the door, a 911 call is made, the fire department has to respond.
And I know you just turned off your pager before this interview, so now hopefully they're not having to call people with you being here instead of there.
It'll be – I field probably about 20 phone calls a day along with trying to see patients. So I can go back and I'll know that there's probably
– a pile up for you.
Phone calls to answer back for whatever reason of, you know. But – yeah, fire always kind of gets caught first.
Yeah, the paramedics.
Yep.
Well, any other things that you have, or is that the main points that you wanted to include?
I mean,
in it?
You never know what's going to happen. You never know what you're going to see necessarily. And I think having that strong ICU background helps you cut through and de-escalate some of the hysterics or the staff that are kind of panicked over something, let you quickly evaluate and get people back. I try to get them out of the milieu of the shelter, because when there's a lot of people around, the performance is usually a little better, mm-hmm. where if I can bring them back to my office where it's quiet and they can be seen there, if medics need to be called without – and things go a lot smoother.
Right. And then you're also able to assess people like the Ashen man that was having a heart attack with your background.
I'm trying to convince him that
it is serious.
You need to call.
Right. Chocolate milk won't take care of it.
Well, he thought it was going to.
Yeah. Right. Well, I really appreciate you taking time today to do this. Mary, you do amazing work. So thank you very much.
Okay.
Right.